Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Swept Away by a Kiss by Catherine Ash. Narrated by Anna Parker Naples. Prologue. Paris, France, 1799. 14 years old, she is merely a child. Stephen Ashford did not bother concealing the puzzlement in his rough whisper. His companion, dark as the night, chuckled despite the stench of sewage and the ankle-deep puddles of the alley in which they hid.
"Ah, but the child foretells the woman," Maximin murmured. "When she grows to be that woman, I will seek her out again, and I will make her mine."
Brow creasing, Stephen tried to discern the set of his friend's features through the curtain of rain. Maximin must be hoaxing. Stephen couldn't imagine otherwise. At 18, Stephen never failed to attract female attention. A few years earlier, he had barely discovered whiskers on his jaw before women became impatient to introduce him to the manifold pleasures of the body. Love, they called it. At first, he willingly complied. But within months, the thrill of his adventure in physical love had paled in comparison to the endeavour that captured both his body and heart. Now, with that heart pounding in anticipation, so loudly he could barely hear the rain slanting around him, Stephen marvelled at his friend's folly.
"You are a fool, Maximin." He shook his head. "Girl or woman, I haven't time for diversions like that, or the desire to—"
His voice stilled. The man they awaited appeared in the mist of rain-flecked lantern light at the alley's end. Stephen steadied himself, sensing Maximin's same ready tension. The caped figure strode down the narrow street, his tricorn ladling tiny waterfalls in three directions. Then, as though aware of danger, he paused.
"Who is there?"
The downpour consumed his cultured accents. He continued forward more slowly, peering to either side. Stephen swallowed. His thumb slipped forward on the ivory hilt of his blade in his palm, tilting the tip upward.
"I know you are there,"
the man said into the flickering silvery black.
"What do you want? Money? I will give you as much as you need, if you allow me safely past. On my honour, I promise it as one citizen to another."
Stephen smiled ruefully. Men in positions of power never believed they could be harmed. Stillness streamed through his veins, cool and stealthy as a midnight ocean breeze. He stood, coming shoulder to shoulder with Maximin in the deluge. They moved into the centre of the alley, one behind, the other in front of the politician. Maximin nodded. Stephen's lips curved again, this time in anticipation.
"We have no wish for your money, Monsieur Representative," Maximin said.
The politician's gaze darted between them, but his voice remained confident.
"Then what do you want?"
His hand moved to the sword hilt at his hip.
"Oui, Monsieur Citizen,"
Stephen replied in equally refined tones.
"Justice, of course."
As one, he and Maximin stepped forward to claim their demand. Chapter 1. Boston, Massachusetts, May 1810. The Right Honourable the Earl of Alverston, Derbyshire, G.B. Dear Valentine, I have been childish. I have been selfish. I have been every kind of fool. But I have now had enough of that sort of thing, and enough of exile. Dearest brother, you at least forgive me. I am coming home. Your unfaithful sister, Valerie. Chapter 2. Breathe, Lady Valerie Monroe whispered into the flutter of breeze curling down the hatchway. The wooden stair gleamed with fresh polish, inviting. Beyond the open hatch above, the azure sky seemed infinite. Setting her foot upon the lowest step, Valerie drew in a tentative breath. As though encouraging her, a current of briny air rushed down the hatchway, tangling in the sable locks escaping her bonnet, beckoning her aloft. She propelled herself up the steps onto deck. Risking her milky complexion, she tilted her face into the late afternoon sun spill and gazed up through lacy rigging into the heavens. The mingled scents of crisp salt water and acrid tar teased her nostrils. Gruff male voices rose through the tumult of activity across deck and on the quay beyond. Valerie filled her lungs, and a smile split across her lips. "I can breathe again." Caught up by the wind, her words sounded like a prayer. She moved to the deck rail. On the dock below, sailors and tradesmen hustled about wharfed vessels, shouting in as many languages as colours billowed from lofty masts. A choir of brawny workers heaved crates and barrels onto her ship. Her gaze followed the procession of men and merchandise aboard, travelling aft, then up to the mainmast's tip, rising high above the roofs of the dockside buildings. A sigh trembled in her throat. In moments, at the whistle of the boatswain's pipe, the Dutch merchantman would embark for Portsmouth. For England. Home. Valerie's starchy American cousins worried about her sailing alone across the Atlantic on a merchant ship. But Valerie didn't care a fig about the crossing. Her only thoughts were for her destination. 2 interminably long years had passed since she'd last teased her beloved brother Valentine, or embraced her dearest friend Anna. Last run barefoot through a velvet Derbyshire meadow. Last tickled her lips on champagne in a Mayfair mansion. Last truly lost her breath dancing in the arms of a gentleman. 2 years of searing guilt. 2 years of alternating heartache and tedium. "Now I am free," she murmured, imbibing the heady sea air like a tonic. "Free of numbing misery. Free to make a new start." Her gaze slipped across deck and over the motley group of sailors making ready to set sail, boys and wizened elders. Dutchmen and ex-slaves, all weathered and wiry with sea-worn strength. Settling into her cabin earlier, she had overheard Cousin Abigail instructing the captain to clear the deck of idle sailors when Valerie came above. It would not do, Abigail whispered, for an unfortunate incident to occur during the crossing. With a giddy breath, Valerie laughed at the recollection. Abigail was a pea-goose. With the Earl dead, what use did Valerie have any longer for common sailors, or undergrooms, or junior footmen? The sun slipped behind the dockside warehouses, casting burnt shadows upon the bay. Soon they would be underway. Soon she would be with her loved ones again. Valerie worried her lip between her teeth. When she stepped off the ship in England, Valentine and Anna would greet her warmly. They might be the only ones. A whisk of wind grabbed a lock of hair and sent it scampering across her sight. Firmly willing away her unwanted thoughts, she drew the dark tress aside. She froze. 10 yards away, upon the dock, stood a man dressed in a black gown and a high-collared cape. Only the sharp edge of white at his neck relieved the grim costume. He held a black hat in one hand. As the breeze pulled at its broad brim, gold glimmered upon his finger. Valerie stared. The black-clad stranger was no country vicar or city bishop, pale-skinned, limp-wristed, and altogether distasteful. Despite his priestly garb, this man positively radiated masculine heat. Her lashes fluttered as her gaze travelled down his habit. The shape of the ebony robes and the hat were distinctive, the breathtaking male shape beneath just as alluring. A Jesuit stood before her. One of the legendary despised race of priests people uttered such thrillingly barbarous stories about. Handmaidens of the Pope, missionaries to jungle savages, and plains bandits alike. They dressed like natives and even worshipped with them. Valerie knew ample, lurid details about the fraternity's members. She was not likely to forget such titillating knowledge, or how she acquired it. Sneaking into the library late at night to read about the scandalous clerics had earned her one of the Earl's most chilling reprimands to date. She'd been only 15. The iciest chastisements came later, culminating in her journey to Boston. To exile. Valerie narrowed her eyes against the gathering dusk. Her girlish imagination had once conjured up a mysterious figure just like this, a man of privilege and power, who nevertheless bore a heathen's heart past redemption. But Valerie was no longer a girl, and the sight of this very real Jesuit's broad shoulders, stretching his mantle taut, stirred in her an entirely womanly appreciation. Captivated, she continued staring as an urchin scurried toward the priest and grasped him around the knee. The child's dusky face looked as grubby as the rags draped over his bone-thin frame. But without hesitation, the priest swept back his elegant cloak and bent. An object passed from the boy's fist into the man's palm. A slip of paper, perhaps. The priest's hand enclosed the tiny one, and his other stole across the matted twists of the boy's hair in a captivating gesture of approval, or possibly affection. He stood to his full height again, and the urchin ran off. "Lady Valerie!" The anxious call of Valerie's maid sliced into her reverie. The priest turned and looked directly at her. His eyes flashed gold in the failing light. A frisson of recognition skittered through Valerie's belly. Her breath caught. She did not know him. She would certainly remember if she'd met him before. At a distance, he appeared handsome, all teak skin and ebony-clad masculinity cast in the slanting rays of sun. But the sense of familiarity clung, spreading to her throat and chest. Disturbed by the absurd impression, she tried to look away, but his gaze held hers like a silken grip. For an instant, as though in a dream, she seemed to look out of someone else's eyes at the solitary figure at the water's edge. Her maid's footsteps sounded upon the planking. Peculiar panic darted through Valerie. She wrenched her gaze from the priest.
"Yes, Harriet." The maid bobbed a curtsy. "Mr. Raymer says the ship is ready to get underway. He wants your company."
"I will be there shortly." Smudges of purple stained Harriet's grey cheeks. Valerie frowned.
"Harriet, you look unwell." "A touch of the megrim is all, miss."
The maid wrung her hands. "You better go and have a rest. I don't want you laid up below deck all month for taking the first day too quickly." Wanting to turn again toward the quay and the priest, Valerie dampened the urge. He was exactly the sort of inappropriate man she once eagerly sought out. But she had changed. 2 years of grief had seen to that. Not even a handsome, mysterious stranger could inspire her to recklessness. Besides, she didn't have anyone to shock with that sort of behaviour any longer. She ushered her maid back to the hatchway. Harriet descended to the cabin, and Valerie started aft toward the captain's observation deck. But an odd warmth gathered between her shoulders, tugging her back. Taking a quick breath, she turned. Not far along the quay, a cluster of sailors rested from the press of last-minute work before the sun's disappearance. A scraggly dog picked around their feet for bits of discarded tobacco. But where the Jesuit had stood was nothing but the worn wood of the dock, and beyond, the darkening lap of water in the bay. He had vanished, just as Valerie's unease at making this journey to England had disappeared. Instead, a spark of excitement sizzled through her, and her blood, so cold for 24 months, hummed with warm anticipation. Valerie. The name rustled through Stephen's consciousness. A memory followed, words sung into the fire smoke in his grandfather's gravelly voice.
"Strong. Her heart is strong. Your path will cross hers, and you must choose which road to tread. But only one will lead you home."
Valerie. Valor. Strength. His grandfather had said much more. Stephen tried to recall it as he strode down the quay in the hush of early evening. But his thoughts were already full of the project at hand. He hadn't the leisure to muse on futile prophecies. His destiny did not matter. Stephen respected his grandfather, but he never much cared for the notion that a man couldn't create his life for himself. Stephen's future had not been predestined, after all. The Natchez blood running in his veins, alongside the blue of the English aristocracy, saw to that. He could have easily spent his lifetime as a pell for men of pure lineage, scorned and beaten for being born a lesser mortal. But he hadn't. Only 10 years old, he'd fled England and forged another future for himself. No, Stephen did not believe in prophecy, even when it involved a beautiful woman. He didn't believe in fate either. A man's future should not be determined by his parents' blood or the colour of his skin, as so many believed. Including the villain Stephen now hunted. On silent feet, he slipped into the warehouse. The note the boy had passed him indicated this as the meeting place his contact preferred. The building echoed dank and cool after the long winter and smelled of brine. Scanning the high-ceilinged chamber stacked with barrels and crates, Stephen's gaze went to the shadows, to tiny windows, other possible escape routes, the usual perusal for such a meeting. He wished he had a sword at his side, regretting the disguise he had donned so long ago it seemed like a second skin, and made bearing a sword impossible. His strength and agility would have to do. At least today he would not be required to brandish a weapon. A man never knew, though. Not when lives and gold and power were at stake, as always in the world of the slave trade. Stephen drew a slow breath, trying to quell the peculiar expectations stirring his senses. Anticipation over the imminent meeting didn't cause it. He knew what was to come. For 2 years, he and Maximin had planned everything carefully. This meeting would merely confirm a final detail. Nothing about it worried Stephen now. But Valerie? A coincidence. Women all over the world bore that name. He'd even shared a bed with one years back, if he remembered correctly, and hadn't given it a second thought. But this English noblewoman, she stared at him so fixedly as though she knew. Stephen shook himself. She knew nothing. She was a complete stranger, and she would remain one despite the journey they were about to share, a journey that would not proceed, as the beautiful Englishwoman imagined. Not if everything Stephen arranged came to pass. Footsteps scuffled upon the sandy floor. A man appeared in the dim light of a lantern. "Angel," he whispered. His gaze skittered around the building, searching for Stephen in the shadows. "I am here," Stephen said, managing not to cringe at the alias given him years earlier. He still thought it was ridiculous. If the men and women working for him truly knew him, they would have named him much differently, no doubt more like the name his mother's people had offered him.
"Expect them in 4 days, father," the man said.
4 days. Long enough to sail past the American naval barricade and still remain within the pirate Babane's territory. Perfect.
"Thank you, my son."
The priestly words slipped easily off Stephen's tongue. He had played the part for so long it barely took effort. Recalling the English beauty's wide, direct stare, Stephen wondered briefly if pretending to be a priest would be quite so easy for the next 4 days. Chapter 3
"Good heavens, not again," Valerie muttered, setting a basin beneath her maid's chin. How a person could be so ill so many times, while the ship moved in such calm waters, Valerie could not fathom.
"I'll be better in a trice, my lady," Harriet moaned, falling back onto her cot. Valerie rinsed a cloth in water laced with her own lavender oil, and placed it upon her maid's forehead. Back in Boston, Cousin Abigail insisted Harriet would make a fine companion for the crossing. Valerie should have known better. The girl's dull temper did not suit her, but Abigail thought of Harriet as a steadying influence on her wild English mistress. Valerie snorted inelegantly, patting her maid's hand, and rose.
"Rest now, Harriet. I'm going above deck for a bit, but I will be back soon."
"But, my lady, you can't. Your cousin..." "My cousin does not have any say over my comings and goings any longer. No one else does either." The words slipped over Valerie's tongue like sweet wine. "We've been aboard nearly 3 days already, and I simply must be free of this cabin. No one will notice if I poke my head above without you."
Harriet groaned again. Valerie tucked the ends of her shawl under her elbows and ducked from the chamber. A few steps along the gun deck took her to the hatchway and up into the bright morning. The Dutch bark was broad and solid, its square sails filled with wind driving it eastward. Scattered sailors worked unhurriedly beneath the early summer sun. A trio of boys at the deckhouse door chased a tune from a pair of mouth organs and a pillbox accordion. The music danced across the decks, mingling with the roll of water carved by the ship's stern and the white-tipped ocean swells.
She did not see the captain at his usual post on the upper deck, and looked toward the prow. Her lashes fanned open. Another passenger stood at the forecastle rail, his black-clad shoulders and back to her. But his virile robed figure and proud stance were unmistakable. The Jesuit. Beside him, the navigator, a hoary old seaman, fiddled with some sort of tool. His hands seemed anxious on the instrument. The priest spoke, and snatches of phrases skittered to her on the afternoon breeze. French. She shouldn't be surprised. A Dutch ship was bound to carry other foreigners, even passengers whose nations were at war, like England and France. Boston had its fair share of monarchist emigres from France's war-torn colonies. Perhaps this priest with the broad shoulders was an aristocrat driven abroad by the revolution. Or maybe he simply sought the adventure that came with a missionary's vows in America. A crease formed in Valerie's brow. Flight from the dangers of revolution she could appreciate, but not that other sort of sacrifice. She would never understand how a man could deny himself intimacy in hopes of securing divine love. In Valerie's experience, human love was hard enough to win. The navigator reached beneath his coat and pulled out an envelope. As though he expected it, just as with the boy on the dock, the priest drew it from the older man's fingers and slipped it into his sleeve. The sailor's face filled with relief. Valerie's eyes narrowed, her pulse quickening. The envelope must contain something of great value to cause the navigator to react like that.
"Welcome atop Lady Valerie," a voice boomed across the deck. "It is a glorious day."
Valerie pivoted to greet the shipmaster. "So glorious, Mr. Raymer, that I have come up without my maid. Unfortunately, she is ill. May I impose upon you for company?"
"Certainly. In such fine weather, no one should cower below. Please join me for some refreshment."
Valerie accepted the master's outstretched arm, and he led her aft. Beneath a sturdy awning, a table was already set with tea and biscuits. Shaking her head at the proffered chair, she leaned against the rail and looked below at the waves splashing against the ship's broad sides. The salt air sank deep into her lungs. Untying her bonnet ribbons, she removed the hat. Her hair worked free in the breeze, and she sighed at the glorious sensation. She had been so proper and well-behaved living with her cousins. But she was not in England yet, and she didn't have anything to hide aboard this ship. None of the sailors would notice if she acquired a freckle or two as penalty for her minor transgression. And aside from Harriet, no one else aboard would care a fig if she went without her bonnet. Certainly not a French priest. The captain regarded her with bashful appreciation as he filled a teacup for her. Valerie smiled over the rim at the Dutch sailor. She liked his affable, fatherly air, a quality the Earl had entirely lacked.
"It's a shame your servant has taken ill in such a fine wind," he said. "Fortunately, we are not likely to see truly inclement skies. You chose a good season to sail."
"Don't you think there is any chance of a storm, Mr. Raymer?
When beauty ventures into the open, not even Neptune dares produce an errant wave to drive her below deck."
The fluid French words caressed Valerie's senses. She swung around to face the priest. This time she hardly noticed his Jesuit costume. He was, quite frankly, astonishingly handsome. Nothing like the stiff, pallid nobleman who pandered to her in London and Boston since her come-out 4 years earlier. The priest's perfect masculinity appeared like an artist's rendering of a man carved from rich marble. The angle of his strong jaw, the sensuous curve of his lips, the aristocratic cast of his brow. Unfashionably long, sun-gilded hair curling around his collar and impossibly high, sculpted cheekbones lent him an exotic air. A rakish air. Dangerous. Valerie lifted her gaze. His flame-laced amber eyes glowed with amusement and the arrogance of a confident adversary. Her heart stumbled. She righted it and tilted up her chin. "You flatter me, monsieur."
"Flattery tends to mislead, mademoiselle. I prefer the truth."
Rich, warm, and startlingly seductive for a cleric, his voice curled into Valerie's belly, tightening it. "The truth. I suppose that is a necessity of your vocation, she quipped, trying to overcome her unexpected reaction.
A rather personal proclivity.
His mouth curved up at one edge, a mouth God had clearly spent great time and care fashioning.
I see. I didn't know men of the cloth were allowed that.
The curve turned into a grin.
On occasion. Dependent upon good behaviour, of course.
Of course.
A smile tugged at Valerie's lips, too. She stifled it. His words teased, but the fiery spark in his eyes remained. He was not flirting with her. He seemed to be challenging, though she could not imagine why. Of course, the French were an overly proud people, especially when they thought they were winning a war. The captain looked anxiously between his passengers, no doubt recalling Cousin Abigail's dire warnings. But he needn't worry. Valerie was through with unsuitable dalliances and foolish escapades, even if her cousins did not believe it. And even if, at the particular moment, her own senses did not seem to believe it either. But she'd always chosen willing partners in her crimes of passion. A Catholic priest, speaking of good behaviour, did not exactly fit the model, no matter how breathtakingly handsome. As on the quay in Boston, he returned stare for stare. But something unsettling was happening in his eyes. The gold glint grew deeper. Knowing. Valerie's insides quivered. He knew she had just dismissed him out of hand. No, he could not read her mind. She blinked to dispel the vision. A lion's eyes gazed back at her. Valerie's blood seemed to rush toward stillness. As a girl, she had seen a real lion at a London menagerie. The priest's slow, penetrating gaze mimicked the magnificent animals. It seemed to warn her that she, always the predator before, had become the prey. Startled by her absurd musings, she wrenched her attention to the shipmaster.
"I suspect good behaviour is a quality Mr. Raymer values in his sailors," she managed. "Don't you, Captain?"
"Yes, indeed," Raymer said with a splutter of relief. "But please forgive me for neglecting my duties as a host. Lady Valerie, allow me to present to you Father Etienne Lemarck, late of the Louisiana Territory. Father, this is Lady Valerie Monroe."
Lemarck bowed, bending his lean frame deeply as though in mock reverence. The wooden beads tucked into the sash around his waist clacked against the crucifix at the end of the chain.
"So then, monsieur," she said,
wishing she could shake herself free of his curious effect.
"On this voyage, should we expect to encounter the dreaded sea god himself, or some of his nereids?"
"Perhaps a stray mermaid."
A half-smile flickered again at his lips.
"One can only hope, my lady."
He seemed genuinely amused now. But for heaven's sake, mermaids! Did priests truly flirt?
"Naturally," he added, with a Gallic shrug, "such encounters depend upon the route we sail."
Raymer chortled.
"Lady Valerie is bound for Portsmouth, father. The Earl of Elverston will meet her there."
The captain announced the noble connection with undisguised pride. The priest tilted his head.
"Family, my lady?"
"Yes. I have lived with my American cousins for 2 years, and I am anxious to return home to my brother's estate. Mr. Raymer has kindly taken me and my maid aboard at the last minute, although I suspect he left valuable cargo behind to accommodate us."
"Yet none so precious, I dare say," the priest said.
Valerie silently exhorted her foolish knees not to turn to jelly. Raymer chuckled gruffly.
"Nothing is as valuable as human cargo, Lady Valerie."
"Good heavens, Mr. Raymer, cargo!" She laughed, but her hands went cold. She'd been weaned on caustic wit, and as the daughter of a peer, she always knew her worth lay in her lineage and dowry. She wilfully flouted that for years, but now that she was trying to make a new start of it, the captain's comment cut too close to the quick. Her gaze slipped to Lemarck. His smile had vanished. The gaff fluttered, setting up a sudden racket, and the heavy boom slipped sideways. Raymer's expression sobered and shifted to the mizzenmast. A sailor hurried over, and the captain stepped aside to speak with him, his thick legs sturdy as the deck tilted. Valerie steadied herself, and her gaze slipped back toward Lemarck.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?